Quickly to Wall. Wall measures. Deal gets open for three. Dagger!
Here comes Pierce with 5 seconds left. Pierce with three. Pierce with two. Pierce all the way at the horn. It's done!
Morris, Ball, Neal, and Gortat. Porter can't find anybody. He gives it to Wall. Marcus gets Bradley for three.
Hey guys, welcome to the Locked On Wizards podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm your host, Troy Halliburton, and joining me today on the other line is the co-founder of Hoop District. He's a Wizards blogging OG. He's a rap aficionado. He's also woke to all the BS of society. My guy, Abdullah Sharif. How you doing today, Abdullah?
What's up, my man? Hey, man, that was a hell of an introduction, man. Happening we're live, though.
No, I'm speaking all the truth right now because you already know how we get down, man. I see you on Twitter. Like you when anything pops up, you're like real quick to be like, nah, hold up, man. Like you know what I'm saying? Like I vibe with that. People who are like just ready to call out all the BS that society wants to throw at us.
Yo, man, I wake up every morning and I promise myself that I'm going to behave on Twitter, that I'm not going to hurt anybody's feelings. I don't hurt people's feelings, but like you said, the clapback is quick. And I try to go easy on some of them. I promise.
But, yeah, man. Hey, man. Hey, but the thing is, I see you moving, and I honestly, I respect you as a person because I happen to know you in real life, you know, not just on Twitter. But, I got a lot of respect for everything that you're building over there at Hoop District. You know, so I told you off air, you guys hire more people than the Monument of Basketball at this point.
Hey, man, it's a revolving door.
Exactly.
Hoop District.
But you got headed up by my guy Neal DeLong's down there, you know, saying, making it happen.
That's my
Shout
son.
Out to the high take care,
Neal,
man.
Neal DeLong is my son. Shout out to my son, Neal DeLong.
Hey.
I'm just kidding.
I know he's gonna listen to this and he's just gonna estimate Abdullah. That's all he's gonna say.
Yeah,
man, but I'm glad that you took the time out of your busy day. You know, we were
recording
a little late so you can take care of all the family business where we can sit there and talk about some late summer Wizards basketball as the team is, you know, they're back from their mini camp in Los Angeles and you know, they're working out in the facility and training camp is going to start at the end of the month. Media day is going to be at the end of the month. So, you know, the season is directly upon us. I know that you're excited to be going into the season.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's going to be kind of like, it's almost going to be like an AAU tournament with all the young guys. I mean, we got what, a half a dozen rookies and a lot of first year players and a couple second year players. So it's going to be fun to watch these young kids develop. Work on the game, playing together at the new facility, of course. We don't got to travel 2 hours to Richmond anymore. So that's a plus. Definitely excited. October can't come quick enough, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I mean, October is literally right around the corner. And when you talk about, you know, the young Wizards that we're going to look forward to watching this season, the most promising and I would say the most polarizing of those young Wizards is Rui Hachimura, who is the team's number one draft pick, first round draft pick from this year. He was drafted 9th overall. And I just wanted to kind of get your impression. We're going to go over, you know, a little bit everything about Rui, FIBA Rui. But I wanted to get your impressions of, you know, what were your initial thoughts when the team drafted Rui? And also, what would you think the fan base's reaction? What did you think about the fan base's reaction to the drafting of Rui?
So my initial reaction, I would say it would be kind of indifferent. I kind of chuckled to myself because I knew that Rui was literally on no one's radar to be drafted. Every projection that you read, every prediction that you read for the Wizards, you know, people were expecting to see a little or, Cam Reddish. Bobo was on some people's radars. He was on mine for a long time. But Rui, not so much. And so when the Wizards picked him, I kind of, you know, just watched the highlight reel and, you know, saw that he had talent that was in a skill set that could be easily developed if the work was put in. But other than that, as far as the Wizards fans' reaction, listen, this franchise is destined for fan of disapproval and criticism, skepticism, cynicism, all the isms. And so, you know, understandably, the fans were kind of shocked, upset. They thought it was another typical Wizards botched pick. Every gun you could jump, they put it out there. And like I said, it wasn't really a good time for the Wizards organization from a front office level. Although they had just fired Ernie, you know, there was no clear idea of who was going to be running the show, even going up to the days of the draft. I mean, no one was really officially appointed as a GM or interim GM. It was kind of like, is Tommy Shepard running it? Is he not? I mean, we eventually knew he was. So with all that said, all that factoring in to going into draft night and then the Wizards, you know, kicking Rui eventually, I think fans were just kind of dumbfounded by him and just really didn't know how to react.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think the fans, I think the initial reaction, I mean, there were people who were saying, you know, man, get Tommy out of here. You know, yeah. Who is this really guy? Really can't shoot threes. Why did we take this guy? You know, there was a lot of that, you know, from the initial draft reaction. But I can honestly say, though, after having fans gotten a chance to watch Rui play in Summer League, and then even more so what he's done in, like, the FIBA exhibition matches and in the actual FIBA tournament games, you know, I think the fans are, you know, starting to, you know, kind of turn the corner here with their perception of Rui. You know, I think you talked about, you know, all the cynicism and skepticism that, you know, Wizards fans have. And, you know, that is nothing but hashtag so Wizards, and which is a real thing. Shout out Kyle Weedon for coming up with this time. But I think that, I mean, something that you said is also real. I mean, you know, as soon as the Wizards fans start turning the corner, I mean, they get the lavish dreams that I had. And now, you know, people are saying, oh, Rui's going to be the next guy. Like, he's up next. And although I don't know if he's going to be up next, I feel like his overall, the outcome of the production for his career will probably be somewhere in the middle of that. He's probably not nearly as bad as people thought that he was on draft night. He's probably not as good as, you know, people are kind of hyping him up to be based off of his FIBA play. But, you know, I think that there is a good sense of for optimism and hope and what Rui can do. What do you expect Rui to do? And first of all, have you gotten a chance to see any of the FIBA action? I know you guys at Hoop District are putting up a lot of content. You got a chance to watch them?
I've definitely watched Rui over the tournament. And I'll tell you what, man, listen, I'm a big eye test guy. Like, I love watching players, young players, and kind of, you know, getting an idea for myself just how talented they can become, what skills they can develop, and how easily they can be developed, and how raw they are, how ready they are. And so watching Rui, I mean, you see, and another thing is that if I see a player do it once on the floor, I know he can do it again, as long as he works on it and he stays consistent with it. So when I see Rui, rolling off a pick really nice to the rim, when I see him going strong under the basket, when I see him drawing fouls, when I see him doing, I mean, he can do a number of things close to the basket. You know, he's got a great short to mid-range jumper. He even as close to the rim as he might be sometimes, he likes to shoot off the dribble. He likes to create for himself. For a big man, that's impressive. So I see these things that he can do already, and to me, it gives me the optimism that if he has the right people around him, if he's being developed right, if he's being developed consistently, and he's working on his game and putting in the work, that he can only go up from here. He can only build on those skills, and that's what gives me optimism. That's what makes me excited for him.
Yeah, I mean, the optimism is definitely growing within me. And I was a person who started out, and I was actually kind of high on Rui. I got a chance to watch a little bit of college basketball last year, and Gonzaga was one of the top teams. And, you know, their non-conference schedule, they played North Carolina, they played Duke. You know, they played all of these teams last year. And they actually split those games. They gave Duke their first loss last year. And, you know, Rui was, you know, he was putting in work. And, you know, the thing that I like about him is the fact that, like you said, the eye test, you know, this might be one of those classic cases of eye test versus analytics. Because, you know, there are a lot of analytics people out there who, you know, were very down on him. A lot of the, you know, main draft analyst guys, even our own Wizards analytics guru, Kevin Broome, was kind of like, I don't know, you know, when he looked at the numbers. But it's like when you watch the eye test, you know, certain things that he does on the court, where you say, man, that was just an NBA play. Like the play they played Turkey the other day, and he had a steal in transition, took the ball, went to the court, dunked on Ersan Ilyasova's head. I'm like, that's an NBA player, what he did.
Right.
So,
I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, but did you really say there was analytical folks judging draft picks?
Here's the thing, I don't want to
hate on analytics. I honestly think they're fun. I think they're fun to look at, to kind of follow. But for a college player to be, you know, to kind of be judged based off of, you know, metrics that he's still developing, it's kind of unfair to me, I think. I think if there's any time you look at the eye test or you rely on the eye test, it's when you're kind of assessing a college basketball player to kind of see, you know, where he's good on the floor, where his comfort zones are, you know, what as a scout, as a coach, what you could do better to get them to kind of, you know, get away from the weaknesses and build more strength. And a lot of that is done by kind of seeing their mannerisms on the floor. You know, how fast are they in transition? How their pace on the floor. All those kind of things I think kind of factor in when you're looking at a basketball player coming out of college and wanting to draft him in the NBA. And so I just had to throw that out there. I don't think analytics is good for college basketball analysis.
No, I'm right there with you because, I mean, the way I look at analytics, and I'm a person who actually does believe in analytics, and, you know, I believe, this is what I believe about analytics. I believe that analytics is a piece of the puzzle. And so if any smart organization, you know, in business or in anything, when you make a decision, you want to have all of the information. That's how you make the best possible decision.
Yes.
So analytics is nothing but information that you can use to make a decision. Now, the thing is, it's just a piece of the puzzle. It's not the end-all, be-all. You can't look at a number chart and say, oh, this is what the analytics say, and this is what we have to do. Because, you know, I mean, that totally negates the fact of human interaction and will and, you know, all these other intangible factors.
Right, exactly.
So, but one of the things that I like about Rui, in college was the fact that he was good at a lot of things. He was highly proficient at a lot of different things. So when you talk about, you know, his low post game and, you know, how he's able to work on the block and how he's able to curl off the screens and get to his mid-range shot, you know, those are valuable skills that are needed in the NBA. And I was just watching this video not too long ago of Eric Spoelstra basically talking about how, you know, trying to defunct the myth that mid-range is dead. And basically what Eric Spoelstra was saying in that video was that, okay, if teams are trying to stop teams from getting layups and three-pointers, he's like, well, what are they leaving open? Because, you know, when you're playing basketball, you can't stop everything. It's physically impossible.
Right.
So if teams are designing their defenses to stop teams from getting layups and three-pointers, then they're obviously giving up the mid-range. So if you have a guy who's a deadly mid-range shooter, then if you run pace from, I mean, he's going to be able to kind of eat off of that next year in a sense. And that's one of the things where I think where his FIBA game will translate to NBA basketball. When you talk about just a guy coming off the screen, using his physical tools, getting to his shot, putting his shot up, and having a good confidence that, you know, at about a 60% clip, that shot's going in from that elbow foul line extended shot.
Exactly. Yep. No, I totally agree. Yeah. I totally agree. I think those are all things that he already has, you know, qualities that he already attains. And again, those are things that you kind of look at and see and know you could build off of. And I think it's going to be great for his future. I hope he develops well in D.C. I think with a lot of guys his age or close to his age around him, they can all kind of develop together, work together, motivate each other. So that's why I'm excited for training camp. I can't wait to see all this kind of unfold over the course of the few weeks that we'll be there.
Yeah. So I can't wait to see Rui get around the team. Rui's still in China right now. Japan team is—they've already been eliminated from advancing to the after the pool play. So his game against the U.S. will be his last game, and then he'll be able to come back. I guess he'll probably get on the charter flight with Tommy Shepard because he's actually over there right now. You know, he's been over there for about 2 weeks now, enjoying time in Japan and in China, just hanging out with Rui and getting to know him. And so, I mean, I think this is kind of big for what the Wizards are doing because they're really, you know, kind of playing up. You see on their social media team and the content that they're putting out, they're really playing up to the fact that Rui is the first Japanese-born NBA player. And, you know, I think that that's a big thing for the Wizards and what they're trying to do. Just, you know, because, you know, we go to the games and we cover the games and we see that, you know, there's not a lot of attention drawn on Wizards games. You know, there's not a lot of media there covering the team. There's not, you know, there's just, this isn't, you know, Madison Square Garden or the Lakers where you got, you know, Brian Windhorst running around all day. It's really not that.
It becomes Madison Square Garden 2.0 when the Knicks fans come to town. That's what it becomes.
Hey, man, the Knicks fans, I'm going to tell you who's really been stepping up these last couple of years, though, man. The Philly fans, they be busting down, screaming, trust the process in the arena. I remember they had this one promo where they bust like 100 fans into the arena.
They were chanting.
They called it bust the process. I was like, you know, that's kind of fire, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but really, you know, when you look at what the Wizards social media team has done and kind of what they've been creating with their summer content, where do you think really fits in from a marketing standpoint for the team next year?
I think it's the biggest splash that the Wizards made with this pick was you know, we talked about, you know, his attributes on the floor, his skill set, what he does on the floor, but from a marketing aspect, I mean, this is almost genius. And I think you and I spoke about this before. I think Tommy Shepard had the full intent of making that decision, mostly based on the marketing ploy that Rui brings. I mean, look at it, man. I mean, you've got the silhouette of the DC Monument in red, white, and blue with the Wizards logo scattered all over Tokyo right now. We could barely see that in PG County. You want to see that in Tokyo now?
We're
worldwide now. It's the international out here sipping Mai Tais with Rui in China. Come on.
Hey, that's real. If I saw
Tommy Shepard and Rui at the bar in China, randomly, you walking, you sitting there, you gonna buy him a drink, right?
Of course, man. Yeah. I don't know what time it is, man. Hey, and luckily, Rui's actually 21, so he could actually have a drink. Maybe we'll have some nice support. That's a Japanese beer. Maybe get some Japanese whiskey, man. I get down, man.
I think Tommy Shepard. Well, I'm not even gonna get into it right now. Anyways, listen. I'm not gonna get into Tommy Shepard's favorite alcohol.
Hey, Tommy's been around and you've been around, so hey, you might have a little inside information on that.
Is he a bourbon guy?
Yeah, I think he might be, man. Hey, I know he listens to Nipsey Hussle, so things are on the table.
No, but listen, on a serious note, yeah, the marketing ploy that Rui is for the team, it's already been remarkable. I mean, we've already seen it from the jump. The Japanese media that has made their way out here following Rui through Summer League, through Draft Night, and it's only going to continue. We're going to see them at Media Day. We're going to see them at training camp. We're going to see them during games. And the fan attraction, you know, the Japanese people love basketball. We know they do. And, you know, we were talking about that article from earlier today, just how Rui, the Brian Windhorst article about Rui's influence on Japanese basketball, how it died out after Michael Jordan's retirement and kind of that whole luster, that whole, you know, that whole affection for basketball kind of died out throughout the country. And he called Rui a generational player for the country. That's big time.
That
carries a lot of weight. That carries a lot of weight. And, it you know, those intangibles that you talk about, Troy, I love intangibles. And we're going to talk about IT later on, but intangibles and Rui having to carry that weight or that country on his back, you know, they're rooting for him. They're counting on him. They want him to be the face of the country from a basketball perspective. And Rui's got that on his, he's got that on his conscience. He's going to have that on his conscience every night. And that we can only hope that makes him an even better player. But you know, like I said, the marketability of it, we can fill up the crowd with our own fans, and we haven't been able to for years. And to have that kind of a man of that stature, you know, from his own country, to come here and bring that passion back to the city, I think Tommy Shepherd knew exactly what he was doing, and I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Japanese population right now, according to the last census, they got 120 million people over there. You know,
yeah,
it's nothing to pick up 100 million extra fans. So, yeah.
It's like picking up 100 million followers all of a sudden.
Exactly. I mean, you talk about you know, the Wizards and their social media team. You know, I can know for a fact that the Wizards tweet announcing that Rui Hachimura was their draft pick was the most tweeted tweet in Wizards Twitter history. So, you know, when we talk about from analytics, from a metric standpoint, you know, the numbers speak for itself as far as, you know, the type of interest that he'll drive in international markets. So, but you already kind of led the way to what we're going to talk about in our next segment. We're going to talk about the veteran guy who's going to come in and be the most polarizing player on the Wizards team next year. But first, I want to let you guys know about Mack Weldon. The opening week of the NFL is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is a premium men's essential brand that believes in smart design and premium fabrics. Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now. Promo code LOCKON gets you 20% at MackWeldon.com. That's promo code LOCKON at MackWeldon.com. All right, so, you know, when we talk about Rui Hachimura, you know, he's definitely, I think, the most polarizing young player and will definitely have his imprint on how good or bad the team will be next year. And I think that he's definitely the most polarizing young player. And conversely, I think that the most polarizing veteran addition to the Wizards team for next year will be Isaiah Thomas. What did you think about the addition of Isaiah Thomas? And, you know, him coming into the team, he was 2 weeks into free agency after the signing of Ish Smith. So, you know, that, I thought that was very interesting. But what do you think about the signing of IT and him being a reclamation project for the team and what he could possibly bring to the Wizards for this season?
So my initial reaction of the IT signing was, I knew it. My second reaction to the IT signing was tweeting you and saying, I told you so. we had talked about when the speculation began for IT making a comeback and him, you know, being ready to be signed to a team, myself and a few others kind of hinted at the notion that the Wizards could possibly sign him, given that, you know, their depth chart at that position was literally empty, except for Justin Robinson. And I knew that with John Wall being out, with the young team, that a presence like IT would be a good fit.
I was definitely one of the guys that said that I didn't think that it was going to happen. So
I knew where you were coming from, and I respected that. I knew where you were coming from. You specifically said because he doesn't move the needle, he doesn't make the team, he doesn't push the team forward. And I get that perspective. But I think that there are certain roster spots that you can fill that fill that other need too that we talked about, that key word, the intangibles. Because when you have a team that is so young, so many new heads, literally, if you don't have IT on the team right now, right? I'm looking at the roster right now on my screen. You know, if you don't have IT right now, your next veteran that you're looking to up to, besides Bradley Beal, right? He's your superstar, right? And
right.
He's a great leader, absolute great leader. But after him, like, you've got Jan Mahimi as the next, you know, most
veteran player.
And you got CJ Miles too, and that's fine. That's all good. But you need some more of that. You need, and who better than a guy who played for a championship caliber team, an Eastern Conference basketball team, finals basketball team, and one that we know very well that can be an assassin, a stone cold killer, a stone cold Wizards killer at that, right?
I remember when he dropped 53 on the Wizards, and that's
what you mean by being a polarized player on the team. At least one reason why he's polarized is because we all remember those bad memories that he gave us with the Boston Celtics. But what does that mean? That means that he's a great player, that he was once a great player. And so it is a reclamation project for him, for the team. And I think that's also a good thing for the Wizards and for IT as well, where he can kind of help these young boys develop. It was kind of weird that he was, or just kind of surprising that he was signed after the Ish Smith signing. I think they're just trying to fill the roster, that position up. Like I said, we had next to nothing at that position before those two. So you got a little bit of depth there while John Wall is out. And I think that you've got two veterans now, Ish Smith and IT, who can kind of go back and forth. Obviously, IT, we're going to be on a need-to-know basis with him. He hasn't played, you know, any semblance of a full season since, what, 2016, 2017? Yeah. So
yeah.
It's been about three full seasons that he hasn't played. More than, you know, 30 games. So he's obviously, got his back against the ropes, trying to make his own personal comeback. He's got his own personal agenda, obviously, trying to get his groove back in the NBA, trying to keep a job. But at the same time, I think, like I said before, his presence, just him being around, him directing some of these young guys, kind of just, you know, just sometimes you just kind of, these young guys kind of automatically feed off of this kind of, this aura, that guys that they watched, you know, when they were in high school, when they were in college, you know, look, now they're playing with them, you know. So I think Isaiah Thomas had a little bit of clout, enough clout to kind of help the team move forward from a veteran leadership standpoint. And, you know, him and, you know, John Wall's going to be around the team too. So you got two, you know, so to speak, elite point guards that one point in their career is elite, you know what I mean? Kind of, you know, overlooking this young cast of players, and again, it's just exciting to kind of see how it unfolds, how it's all going to work out. So I think it's a good pickup. I think it's one that's going to help the season be a little bit more, keep us a little bit more sane throughout the season, as we watch all these young kids, you know, get a lot of playing time. So we'll just see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll definitely be entertaining. That's one adjective that I could definitely use. But I mean, I can honestly say, as somebody who was skeptical of the team signing IT before the season, before free agency even really began, I think that what he can bring to the team is twofold. It's both what you said. It's the veteran leadership, which is something that I think this team desperately needs, as a team that, you know, has made it an agenda to attend to team culture and attack
right.
the team culture
right.
when they let go of Ernie Grunfeld, when they headed into the offseason. You know, that was one of the key words that they kept using, trying to get the team culture right. And so, you know, you're
right.
bringing in a guy, IT, and, you know, he exudes just positivity just all around. I mean, we're talking about a guy who, you know, wakes up every morning and tweets out Nipsey Hussle marathon lyrics. And it's like, you know, so like, I mean, when it comes to, you know, staying on course, finishing the race, like, you
right.
know, he's going to bring that type of energy
exactly.
to the Wizards
exactly.
next season.
Exactly. And you know
yeah.
what? The Wizards have always needed this kind of presence within the roster. If you look back at it, you know, historically, just going back, you know, 6-7 years past, when they've been, you know, at a high level, morally, not just on the floor, but just at a high level morally, it's been when they've had this kind of leadership. Even when it was Emeka Okafor kind of keeping John Wall in check at one point, Nene, Al Harrington, Paul Pierce, of course, Drew Gooden, all these guys are high morale players that kind of lift the team up, lift the young guys up, particularly the guys that don't have a sense of direction on their own, guys that haven't matured enough. Having that kind of leadership to kind of just kind of move them along, it speaks bounds. You know, it's those things that, you know, you're not going to see on paper, but at some point it may reflect on the court when they need that comeback win, come from behind win, or when they go in a little 3-game winning streak, you know, or when they win that big road game. You know, that's the kind of thing that this kind of leadership will fuel and boost morale up, make those guys feel good about the culture. Like you said, culture is huge. They can have a foundation for their culture through this leadership that Isaiah Thomas brings them. And that's about that. That's all I got to say about that.
but you know what? I'm going to pick up right where you left off, though, and I think that he's going to bring some good things to, you know, boost the team's morale. But this goes to one of my favorite Jay-Z lines of all time: more victories is for minor league coaches. And so what that basically means is, you know, morale is good and having, you know, the moral victory is good and having boosting the team's confidence is good.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of the day, like, what can we tangibly do on the court? And, you know, I'm actually beginning to think that he's going to be able to contribute on the court, too. When you look at the fact that, you know, he's had, you know, hip surgeries for the last, you know, 2 summers. So basically, he's coming into this last, you know, few seasons where he's not even able to train. So this is the first year where he's actually coming to the off season. And he's been able to train and, you know, get his body right. And, you know, he says he's got his weight down. And, you know, I talked to a few people, a few team employees who were at the team's mini camp 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles. And, you know, they told me that Isaiah Thomas looks amazing. So, you know, like, when we talk about what he can bring to the team from a morale standpoint, that's great. But, you know, I'm excited to see, you know, what Isaiah Thomas can do on the basketball court. And I think one of the biggest things that we have to look at is the fact that, you know, he has the opportunity in front of him. You know, whereas last year in Denver, I think that by the time that he got healthy, you know, you're dealing with a team who almost won 60 games. You know, they don't have time to, you know, be trying to integrate Isaiah Thomas into, you know, their offensive scheme and what it is they're doing. But, you know, as far as the Wizards go, you know, the Wizards are projected to win 27 games this year. So, you know, when it comes to minutes and playing time, you know, he's going to have his opportunity. Now, however this story ends is going to be totally dependent upon Isaiah Thomas. Because, I mean, Ish Smith is a good player, but Ish Smith is, you know, he's a 25-minute-a-game player. You know, that leaves a lot of minutes for Isaiah Thomas to, you know, kind of get on the court and show what he can do. So, how do you feel that, you know, he's going to be able to fit? And who do you think will start, Ish Smith or Isaiah Thomas, coming into this season? And who do you think is going to have more of an impact throughout the season?
So, there's a lot of layers to this question, to the point guard situation overall, and I think you touched up on a lot of it as far as how IT's going to be on the floor. Who's going to start? I'm kind of torn on that. I think if Isaiah Thomas is 100%, if he's like 100% and he's getting in his reps in training camp and in practice and he's getting acclimated with the first team, I think he should start. I think if the coaches feel like he is at that level where he is 100% healthy and he is comfortable playing with the offense, with the first-team offense, then he should start. I think if he falls short of any of those two, I think there's a higher chance that Ish Smith starts. I want to talk about Isaiah Thomas, and one thing about him on the floor is I'm excited to see it, but I'm also nervous to see it because we're talking about a small guy who we already know one of the biggest qualms you had about him was that he's one of the biggest liabilities on defense.
And, I mean, statistically, the worst defender over the last 5 years in the NBA.
And one of those, partly the reason for that is his inability to really play well around screens. And with a hip injury, with two hip surgeries, I don't know where he's going to be mentally in terms of that being on his conscience, those hip injuries, because when he's fighting through those screens, he better go under every screen. And I don't know what, and hope the guy misses the jumper. Because
if he got to go through a screen, he puts himself out here trying to get hurt.
Yeah, you go through a screen and you get that one little hip check and it kind of knocks you off balance and you tweak something, you know. I don't want to see it. I hate to see it, but it's one thing that's on my mind is saying how much has these injuries impacted him mentally on the floor. Knowing Isaiah Thomas and knowing, his work ethic and his mental state generally as it pertains to, you know, the game of basketball, he's going to be tough. He's going to go out there. He's going to give it 110%. I don't doubt that one bit. I'm just kind of nervous for him, kind of seeing him out there and just seeing exactly how, you know, just how well or how badly he's going to produce on the defensive side, you know. Fighting through those screens, being able to kind of either drop back or on switches when he gets matched up against a bigger defender, those kind of things kind of worry me a little bit. Offensively, like I said, he's a pacemaker. He's going to be able to kind of, you know, move the offense up and down the floor at a smart pace, and that'll be big. So I kind of see them staggering the two point guards. I don't know how Scott Brooks is going to do it, but with them being so thin, I don't think we'll ever see them on the floor at the same time. But we'll probably see Isaiah Thomas with the second team a little bit, Ishmael with the first team, and vice versa. It's going to be interesting to see how Scott Brooks decides to rotate his two point guards.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say one thing that Isaiah Thomas has in his favor is that. Scott Brooks loves the 5'9" small point guards because he sees himself in Isaiah Thomas for sure.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you this: if Isaiah Thomas don't play this season, it ain't gonna be Scott Brooks, right? Trust me, I know Scott Brooks. Like he wants Isaiah Thomas to come out here and kill this year, right? He's gonna do everything within his power to have that be the little guy narrative. Scott Brooks is all about that. So,
that's another good point. You know, that whole point guard coach relationship. You know, I'm glad Isaiah Thomas is having a good one with Scott Brooks. I think it's going to pay dividends if it continues to kind of work out that way.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm looking forward to what Isaiah can do, and you know, I can already attest. I think that he and Scott Brooks have already gotten off on a very good note, and
right.
You know, I think that, you know, like I said, from everything that I've been hearing from, you know, from what he did out there at the mini camp, and you know, the team is working out at the practice facility even right now, and
right.
Everybody says the same thing that Isaiah Thomas looks good, that, you know, everybody's saying it. So, you know, this is making me more of a believer, even though I started out as a skeptic. But, you know, I think that I'm excited about what Isaiah Thomas can bring. You know, I think that it would definitely be the complete opposite of #SoWizards to have, you know, a reclamation project on the team. And, you know, to go along with Rui, the guy we were talking about earlier, you know, if Isaiah Thomas gets going, he definitely will put butts in the seats too. So I know Ted Leontis will definitely like that.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
All right, man. But we've gotten all of our Wizards talk out of the way. On the other side of this break, we're going to talk about a little bit of hip hop. We're going to delve into our top five rappers of all time. I kind of have a sense of where you're going with this, just knowing of how much you love New York rappers. But I don't want you to get mad at me once I reveal my top five and have it ruin our friendship.
Oh, man. All right, let's see how it goes.
All right, man. But first, let me tell you about DoorDash. Long day at work, still stuck at the office? Open the DoorDash app. Choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you, wherever you are. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app. Enter promo code LOCKEDON. All right, now, Dula, man. If you fast forward, I'm going to put a time stamp on the podcast. If you don't want to listen to No Wizards Talk, you better listen to this part of the podcast. Abdullah and I are going to break down our top five rappers of all time. We're going to keep it at five because we want to keep the list short. But I remember a few weeks back on Twitter, there was this list of the best rappers alive, or not alive, but the best rappers of all time going around.
It was a good list. It was a good list.
I said, whoever made this list is either on Rikers Island right now or just got off Rikers Island.
Stupid.
come on, Joe Budden, top three. Styles P. Like, I love Styles P. Top 10, though. Come on, man. We got to stack bundles in front of Lil Wayne. Like, it was just like the New York bias was just weakened. From that list, but you know what, man? Let's go back and forth. Let's start from five going up to one, and we'll both go in each order. I'll let you go first since you're the guest.
Okay.
Who's your number five rapper of all time?
All right, I'm gonna say Rakim.
Rakim. Okay. MB or Rakim. I like it, man.
What's yours? Am I going 5-1?
No, I'm going to go 5-2. So my number five rapper of all time is Dwayne Michael Carter, a.k.a. Lil Wayne. That's my number five rapper of all time, man.
Okay. So my number four is Jay-Z.
I was not expecting that. Ooh. Man, Jay-Z coming in at four. We're gonna have to talk about that.
Listen, listeners, Troy, mind you, I turned 38 in a month. Okay, so these names, my number one and two, I'm not gonna give it away, but it's very cliche. But mind you, my age and the influences these rappers have at the particular points of their career. So go ahead.
So when you talk about Jay-Z, I'm just trying to figure out how Jay-Z can't at least be in the top three are you letting your NFL bias come in?
So what bias?
Are you letting your NFL bias come in?
My top five has been consistent for years. I mean, since I can remember, it's never changed. I've always tinkered with Eminem being in my top five, because I look at rappers from a very strict, lyrical, poetic, artistic form perspective. Right?
Hey, if my list would have gone to six, Eminem would have made it. I was thinking about that before.
Let me tell you something. Here's another thing. I'm only ranking them because you honestly told me to. Generally, these will be my top five. I don't really like ranking my top five. I think it's a disservice to the rappers to say one is better than the other. My top five, my five guys, it's hard to say one is better than the other because they're perfect at the way they rap.
It's pretty much based on the consumer and what it is that you're looking for.
It's not about record sales. It's not about music videos. It's not about money. It's about how do you perform? How do you deliver the best way you can deliver? And my top five delivers the best way they can deliver.
And I feel that. And Jay-Z, for me, I mean, I think that he's probably one of the most technical rappers because he has so many rapping styles. I'm saying, when you talk about early Jay-Z, like off the influence of the jazz, the fast rapper style, Hawaiian Sophie, you know what I'm saying, Reasonable Doubt. And then until you get into, like, the older Jay-Z where, you know, he's really able to slow it down and really explain and tell all of his stories, and then Jay-Z over Bounce Beats, Jay-Z over, I feel like I'm giving my hand as to what my list is going to end up. But, I'm going to go to my number four is Andre 3000. The South got something to say.
Good. I respect that. Outkast, Andre 3000, I mean, he's on a lot of people's top five. I'm gonna let you expand, but I just wanted to make the point. When I'm talking about when you deliver in your best form, I mean, who else can deliver like Andre 3000, right? Who else can come out with the wordplay, you know, just the playfulness that he raps with? It goes hard. You know what I mean? It's like, dang, yo, this shit is fun, but it goes hard too. And that's what I love about my man.
Yeah, man. Exactly. Andre, I mean, he has a very distinct style that you know, yes. is clearly his own. And, yes. you know, when you look at, you know, the Outkast discography and, you know, Andre's own, his solo work, and then when you even look at, I mean, I think that what solidified Andre being in my top 10 and ultimately my top 5 was that range from what's that about, like maybe like 2008 until like 2012, where Andre was just doing features. Like, oh my
right.
God, like he, like, I mean, he was coming on everybody's songs, just completely murdering songs. And like, you know, those are some of my favorite Andre 3000 verses, you know, on top of everything he did with Outkast. So, you know, I'm a big Andre 3000 fan, so, you know, I just wanted to throw that out there. But go ahead with your number 3 artist.
Escobar Season.
Hey, Nasty Nas, that's my guy, man. So Nas for me would probably be about like 7th. I would have Nas behind Eminem, but I love Nas, man. And I'm also, I think we've had this conversation on Twitter before. I'm one of the few people who actually thinks that It Was Written is better than Illmatic. And so when people say that Nas only... When people say that Nas only has one classic, I scoff at that because,
no.
you know, it was written as a complete classic. I mean, Stillmatic is almost a classic. It's not quite a classic, but, I mean, actually, you know what, man? You know, fuck it, man. I mean,
we got Issa
on there. Stillmatic is a classic, too. So he really got 3 classics when you really think about it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. So let me tell you something about Illmatic. Illmatic, it's not the greatest album because, you know, because of its content, but because what it represented, what it symbolized.
Right.
And what Illmatic symbolized was the foundation, like the resurrection of hip hop in New York. And New York had hit a brick wall in terms of musically, in the late 80s to early 90s. And Nas and Wu-Tang and some of these other artists, producers, especially producers, DJ Premier, Q-Tip, all these guys kind of really resurrected the culture and art of hip-hop in New York. And Nas was the walking encapsulation of that, so to speak. Because when Illmatic dropped, we're going to talk about the lyrics in a minute, but from a production standpoint, I mean, he had 6 different producers on the album. I mean, like I said, namely Q-Tip, P-Rock, a couple others that were on there that all, because Nas was such a hit on the street lyrically, he was such a hit on the street before he got signed, that when he was getting ready to start his album, there was like a bidding war between producers of who's going to produce his album, when Nas said, you know what, fuck it, all 6 of y'all coming to my studio, and so they all collabed on the album. So it was really like a symbolic, like a landmark in hip hop history for New York. So that's why Illmatic was so huge. And then when you would talk about the lyrics, the storytelling of Nas, and this is why, going back to my whole thing about, you know, how we judge rappers, judging by what they do best. Nas and Jay-Z, when it comes to the art of storytelling, when it comes to painting a picture, especially Jay-Z and Reasonable Doubt and Blueprint, like he was written, and I'm sorry, before Blueprint,
Volume One might be my least favorite Jay-Z album, man.
Sunshine,
oh my God, what were you thinking?
But so storytelling wise, that's why Illmatic was such a hit. But when it comes to It Was Written, I mean, the tracks on that, we talked about it. Remember, I think you were tweeting about it online. We were talking about the different tracks, Affirmative Action, Shootouts, Black Girl Laws.
Yeah, man, I Gave You Power, man. That's one of my favorite lines. Like, that's the story. We talk about storytelling. with love tells a story, and I'm a gun, and, like, I've been in half, and, you know what I'm saying, like, yo, dog, like, dog, like that, I mean, that, when I first heard that, that blew my mind, like,
let's talk about Rewind on Stillmatic, where he tells the story backwards.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, man, it's like some Quentin Tarantino Pulp Fiction shit.
Oh, my
God. You know what I'm saying, like, like, hey, but when I first heard New York State of Mind, you know, on the CD, on the disc, man, you know what I'm saying, like, that New York State of Mind, like, I could picture myself in the Queensbridge Project hallway,
right,
like, in a cellar,
so
drinking E&J, like.
Yeah, that's a Primo track, and I've seen an interview with Primo's talking about when they first said, ding, 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 you know, that beginning of New York State of Mind, and he was just kind of walking the viewers through the you know, him and Nas listening to his beat for the first time. You get goosebumps just listening to him, because you kind of painting that image in your, you know, you kind of living that scene in your head where Nas and Premier just kind of like listening to his beat and nodding their head, and then the bass kicks in, the beat drop, you know, and it's like, whoa, this is gonna be a hit, and
yeah,
it'll be it. So yeah. Hey, man, what's your number three, bro?
All right, my number three, this is where it's going to get real controversial. Don't judge me, please.
I love it. Go
ahead. All right, my number three, the Louis Vuitton Don, Kanye West.
Okay.
That's my number three.
All right, man. Hey, listen.
Hey, but I got to explain myself on this, right?
Go ahead.
I feel like Kanye, when you talk about what Nas did for New York rap, I feel like Kanye did that for backpack rap. And you know what I'm saying? Like, I come from, he really kind of spoke to me as like a kid coming out of D.C. Like, you know what I'm saying? I never sold packs on the corner. I don't know. I never, you know what I'm saying? That wasn't my life. Like, you know, I wasn't a drug dealer. You know what I'm saying? Like, I went to college.
Yeah.
Like, so like, when Kanye was talking about, oh, back when they thought pink polos and hurt the rock before Cam got this shit to pop. You know what I'm saying? That was me. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and being a college kid, like wearing polo shirts, like, you know, gallivanting around D.C. Like, you know, that, like, I just related to Kanye in a different sense. And, you know, I mean, quiet as it's kept, I think that the guy has, you know, no less than five classic albums. Like, I mean, I get into debates every day with people on what was Kanye's best album. And I've heard people say six different albums is Kanye's best album. So,
exactly,
like, I mean... When he would talk about it, they say, oh, well, he's not a lyricist, and, you know, oh, he doesn't... You know what I'm saying? He might not even write all of his lyrics.
Right.
The early stuff, he wrote a lot of that stuff. He definitely had, you know, a little help. But I think when it comes to just musicianship and your impact on culture, like, I think, I mean, Kanye West, I mean, that's my guy, and I'll ride or die. Now, if Kanye starts talking crazy on Twitter, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to be like that Russell Westbrook gif and bleed it to the side, eat my chicken, don't look at me.
But see, you know what? You say it's controversial, and I can see why it is, but your perspective of it is totally understandable and absolutely respectful. When you say the whole, you know, when it resonates with a certain part of your life, with a certain aspect of your life, you know, the whole, like you said, backpack rap, right? So I wasn't a backpacker when Kanye dropped. So I was a little older. So my Kanye experience was when Dipset shouted him out on We Are the Champions, and they were like, this is the producer on the track. And I'm like, hold on a second, hold on, whoa. And then he's sick. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, yo, I said, Dipset goes hard. They got the fucking producer on the track. I'm sorry. I'm dropping. We're talking about hip-hop now. I'm starting to cuss a lot.
No, it's good. Don't worry, man.
So we were bigging up Dipset. Like, wow, these guys are killing the game right now, especially the mixtape game, because Kanye got off the board and hit the mic, and it was like, oh, wow. And then Through the Wire came out. And that was his first fit. And I didn't like Through the Wire that much. I thought it was a good song, like one.
Yeah, but that slow jams is the one that changed the game.
So from there, Kanye, when he starts to drop the album with the radio hits, you know, Jesus Walks comes out, and, you know, like Workout Plan, he's like, oh, my goodness, like, wow. he's actually killing it on both ends. And so, but like I said, man, when a rapper, when an influence of a rapper kind of really hits you hard, resonates with you, I respect that because there's a warranted, you know, reason for you to have that opinion. And I noticed, you know, your first three rappers, 5, 4, and 3, none of them were New York based, and all of mine are New York based.
My New York rappers are coming. Don't worry. My last two. That's spoiler alert. My last two are New York rappers. Go ahead.
Okay. So you said 2 and 1. They're both New York rappers. Okay.
My 2 and 1 are both New York rappers. Who's your number two?
So my number two is Big.
Okay. That's also my number two. So let's go ahead. Let's chop it up.
I have a 1A and a 1B, to be honest.
Okay, I'm curious to know what your one is now.
He's not a New York rapper.
Okay. Nah, but let's go ahead and chop it up about Big. So we got something in common. Number two rapper. I'm going to tell you why Big is my number two rapper of all time. Big, the way Biggie Smalls rides the beat, is like better than I've ever heard anybody ride a beat in my entire life. Right?
Yes.
So the way he stops, pause, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he taught rappers how to let the beat do some of the work sometimes. Everybody try to rap over every part of the beat. Sometimes you gotta rap, pause, let the beat go a little bit, you know what I'm saying? Like, the way he rolled a beat, I mean, he really taught, like, I mean, he, you know, in a roundabout ass way, right, he really birthed all of this, you know, the auto-tune and singing and all this other stuff, right, because he taught people how to ride the beat. Well, rappers before that, they weren't riding beats like that. But Big really, he really brought that into the rap game, like the way that he flowed, right, his melody. It was something special, and it had never been seen before in the rap game. But tell me why you love Big.
So, for me, Big... everything you said, again, me and you, man, this wavelength you and I got when it comes to just our thoughts on sports and music. But the way Biggie wrote a beat, his delivery was unlike anything that I've ever heard, and I still can't hear. Like you said, his ability to ride the beat with his own words, with his voice, is remarkable. And then on top of that, it's just, you know, his wordplay, his ability to rhyme. His rhyming scheme was just, you know, and like I said, like, he'll do it. His rhyming scheme combined with the way he delivers it, and like you said, riding the beat. Like, who else can do, like, B-I-G, P-O, P-P-A,
no info, for the D-E-A.
Like, come on.
It
sounds so simple, right? But, like,
yeah.
In a million years, you wouldn't be able to deliver like that. Or even think
never,
about it like
never.
That,
I would never
right?
think to deliver how he did it. Yep.
Yeah. And so, for me, Biggie, like, for him to be, I mean, honestly, bro, Biggie was 24 when he got killed. He dropped 2 studio albums. And the weight those 2 studio albums hold, you know, surpasses, you know, most rappers' entire discography. And it really does. Like I said, it's considered a cliche pick. Oh, Biggie, you know, Biggie, yeah, of course, Biggie. But honestly, like, if you really kind of break it down and look at his career, look at the shortness of his career and what he was able to kind of establish and create.
And the influence, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like, there would be no Jay-Z if there was no Big.
Exactly. Like, the people that he put on the map, you know, especially in Brooklyn, the Fabs, the Jay-Zs,
Cameron, Mace, like the Locks, like, you know what I'm saying, like a tree of dope rappers that came from Big and the whole Bad Boy movement.
Exactly, and it's also the same time that Biggie came out. You know, like I said, that early '90s, you know, resurrection of hip hop in New York. And but the fun thing about Big is that, while he had a lot of quarrels with a lot of local rappers, a lot of New York rappers. Him and, like, Nas, you know, admitted that him and Big, you know, he said, you know, Nas said kicking the door, waving the 4-4. He was like, that's about me. Big and Wu kind of clash heads. So while everybody was on the come up in New York, Big was the first commercial rapper that kind of put New York officially on the map, because you had the Wu-Tang, but there's still more, you know, kind of a little too gutter for mainstream, you know, pop radio. But Big kind of took that revolution of hip hop in New York and kind of took it mainstream and brought on all his people with him. Lil Kim, Lil C's, Junior Mafia. You know what I mean? I mean, the list goes on, and he just, like I said,
exactly.
A pioneer of the time.
Urban legend is saying, you know, Diddy stole
yeah.
Big's rhyme.
And he did
the whole, you know,
yeah.
No Way Out is a whole Big album.
Yeah.
Man, that's some urban legend. We don't want to get into too many conspiracy theories on that. But
you talking about after his death?
Yeah. I'm talking about the fact that, you know, people say that, you know, that Diddy really took Big's rhyme book.
I used to have strong opinions about that, and a lot of it was out of anger, because you were really, if you listen to hip hop when Biggie got killed, you were pissed off. You were fucking pissed off, because that whole East Coast West Coast shit was so real. It was so intense. Like when Hit 'Em Up by Tupac came out, I was scared. I was like, this dude is scaring me right now. Like he is mad. And then and that being perpetuated by the whole shooting in Manhattan, like this stuff was real. And you were like, damn. And then when Biggie went out to the Source, was it the Source Awards where he got killed?
He was at LA at post Grammys. Yeah.
Post Grammys.
Biggie got killed in LA.
He kind of mocked L.A. on the podium. He was like, what's up, Cal?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I'm here. What's up?
Yeah, we were here. It's all going back.
And when he did that, everyone kind of held their breath. Like, oh, come on, Big. This shit is serious, man.
Yeah. Especially when you look at, now, I've watched, you know, hundreds of hours of Vlad TV interviews and,
yeah,
you know, trying to figure out what it is. You know, I mean, I think that when you look at it, that, you know, P. Diddy was probably very culpable in a lot of that negative energy that was being put out there from on Big's behalf. But, you know, that's a whole other podcast just on, you know, those conspiracy theories. But look, let's finish our song here with your number one rapper of all time.
Wait, what's your number two? What's your number two?
I said my number two is Big. We both Big.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Okay. My number one, like I said, my number one cliche pick, it's my 1A, 1B, whichever you want to call it, is Tupac. Tupac is my number one. Number
God.
Yeah, I told you it was cliche.
That was a total curveball. I did not expect that coming.
Really?
So
I told you it was going to be a cliche pick.
Pac will be in my top 10, but I don't think he reaching top 7. Like, I would say this. Pac is one of those, he's a quantity over quality rapper for me. But what I will say is this. When it comes to that real street poetry rap, Pac is the godfather of that. So when you talk about, you know, these other guys who are Lil Boosie, or Kodak Black, or, you know, these are guys who kind of spawned from that same kind of tree where they're, you know, they're talking street poetry stuff. You know, and obviously Pac was the best at it, and Pac was so vicious that, I mean, his discography, I mean, you know, what's he got, about 8 studio albums, 9 studio albums, something like that?
Right.
He was only 25 years old, I mean, and he was locked up for like 2 of those years too.
Right.
So, like, when you think about, like, you know, when you talk about his work ethic and, you know, what he was able to do with the music game and the impact that he had, you know, I had no problem with you saying that he's your number one rapper. Right?
Yeah. So, you mentioned something interesting, you know, the whole quantity versus quality. And I'm a quality guy. Like I said, Big only had two albums. Nas only had 2 or 3 really good albums. And so on. And even Jay-Z, you know, like, you know, he's had a couple duds, but he's got 3 or 4, some people might say 5 quality albums. But with Pac, again, it's all about what you're great at. And Pac rapped with a passion. He rapped from the stomach, right? Whereas Big did a delivery, you know, from, you know, through his wordplay, and addiction and delivery. Pac kind of rapped with a passion from the stomach. and he did it well. And it was music, it was songs that really got in your head. It was kind of like a guide, not a guidebook, but kind of like, you know, like something that you kind of just live off of. Because he rapped about everything. He rapped about, you know, women in the hood. He rapped about, you know, partying, dancing. He rapped about political stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
And on top of that, like, one of the things that in hip hop, you know, hip hop is a battle scene, you know, and when you start getting into beats, this is why some of my favorite rappers are the ones that get into beats, right? Like Eminem, like 50 Cent, right? Like those kind of guys that kind of like test other rappers, you know, put it in their face, call them out, start beefs. And Pac was kind of like that. He was very contentious, and he rapped very contentiously, and it kind of boosted you as you listened to it. And again, these are very, very key times in my life where I was in ninth grade when All Eyes on Me came out, and like there's a double CD, and like, you know, we're recording songs off the radio, we're rushing to Up Against the Wall, Nobody Beats the Wiz, to go get these tapes. and disc one of All Eyes on Me was all his radio hits, right? And then we didn't even listen to disc two till like a month later, and then you realize, holy shit, disc two is even better than disc one. All the hits that didn't make the radio were on disc two, and it was just an all around classic. And that was right around like my early high school years, so it was kind of like that's what it was. And then you had the whole going back to the East Coast West Coast rivalry. You had your friends that were Pac heads. You had your friends that were big heads. I had family in California. We used to go back and forth all the time talking about it. And then you talk about, you know, other rappers that got caught up in between Nas and Mobb Deep and all these people. I'm a big New York guy. So even though I called Pac my number one, I sided with New York a lot against him when he called out Mobb Deep and hit him up. I was like,
Mobb Deep. So what do y'all got sickle cell or something? I was like, oh, don't do that, Pac. Why you do that?
I leave my man alone. And the funny thing about that is that when Prodigy had sickle cell, when Prodigy died, I was really sad about it. But I was kind of, my reflection of it was remembering how much, while we listened to Mobb Deep back in the 90s, we knew Prodigy had sickle cell. We were like, this guy's going to die any minute, like any day now.
Yeah, but then he ended up living 20 more years.
Finishing his career. So, like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I'm sad to see him go anyways, but I'm so grateful that he lived through his career, you know, up until the point where they started making trash albums, you know what I mean? But, yeah, so Pac had that thug influence on, like, when you talk about a thug, like the whole thug life thing, that's what Pac kind of portrayed to the fullest, and it hit you hard as a kid. It made you feel grown, like, yo, thug life, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm with you, man. Oh. Like, no, Pac, like, when you talk about that All Eyes on Me, how it opens up first track, Ambitious as a Rider. I won't deny it. I'm still out of. Hey, like, you said, no, I'm hip to Pac. He's in my top 10. You know, like, I it's so many great rappers, and music is so subjective. But the same way that I explained my love for Kanye West, the way you just explained your love for Tupac, I would never be able to deny that.
Let me give you a drum roll.
My number one rapper of all time, man, is Jay-Z, man. Jay-Z's the best, man. Like, when you talk about, like, the longevity in the game, the amount of classics, man. I love all Jay-Z albums, man.
So, Troy, I'm going to cut you off, because I really want to know this. What was the first Jay-Z album you heard? Was it Reasonable Doubt?
No, the first Jay-Z album I heard was Volume 2. So, Hard Knock Life, I was probably in the elementary school when I first started getting into music. Hard Knock Life, when I heard the author Annie song, I was like, yo, who's this guy? That's dope. And then, like, but then I started listening to the other joints of the Volume 2. So when you talk about, you know, Jigga What, Jigga Who, you know what I'm saying, Money Cash Hoes, like, you know what I'm saying, different stuff. Like, that's when I started getting into Jay-Z. Then I went back and listened to Reasonable Doubt. And then I was like, oh shit, this is the guy, like, you know what I'm saying? And then in the same time, like, so I'm getting to put on with Volume 2. And then he comes out Volume 3, Big Pimpin. I remember downloading Big Pimpin. My sister is older than me. She went away to college. She came back. She had the computer. She had the Napster. I remember downloading Big Pimpin off of Napster on her computer. Like, you feel me?
Let's talk about Big Pimpin for a minute. Do you know the drama behind Big Pimp?
Yeah, that Pimp C ain't want to do the song because he wasn't fucking with Jay-Z. Exactly. He ain't want to do the song. And so that video was shot in Trinidad. Pimp C's part is shot in Miami. That smoking out, potent up, keep that lead up in my cup.
My
car got living wood in my hood. We call it book. Hey, that was shot in Miami instead of a Benz in Miami, while Jay-Z and Bun B was in Trinidad at Carnival going ham. You know, I remember Big Pimpin. I remember that music video when Dame Dash was pulling the Almond Bell on the girl.
Oh my God.
Like, you know, saying sixth grade me, I was like, yeah, this is where I want to be when I grow up, right there. Like, I want to be on a boat. Elder in the boat in the Caribbean, pour all the girl and the woman. That's what sixth grade me was thinking.
So I think this is amazing. This is a great conversation because we admire the same rappers, Jay-Z, but kind of listening to how you got into Jay-Z versus how I got into Jay-Z, it's real cool to talk about because you started off with, like you said, the Hard Knock Life, Money Cash, Ho, Jigga What, Jigga Who. Some heavy radio hits, right? And then Reasonable Doubt. So Reasonable Doubt is a whole different dynamic.
It's a totally different album. That's a Mafia movie. It's a rap album.
Jay-Z's first single was Dead Presidents.
Right.
And Dead Presidents, that beat, the Nas sample, the flow, I mean, it's so gutter, so New York, so hood. And so Jay-Z, for me, when he came out with that song, I was like, oh, my God, this is just – what a banger. 1996 is my favorite year.
I've been seeing a lot of people talk about 96
year.
As a rap year.
95, 96. I mean, you're talking about Prime Jay – not Prime Jay, but up-and-coming Jay. Talking about Prime Nas, Prime Wu, Pac. You know, all these guys were just in their primes. New York rap was at a high. Dr. Dre, of course. And so when Jay-Z came out, so, I mean, every track off of Reasonable Doubt, I mean, just about, you know, like Friend of Foe.
No, Reasonable Doubt is my favorite Jay-Z album by far.
Okay.
Like, you
okay,
know what I'm saying? Like, we on the same page. I love one of my favorite tracks is 22 Twos. I love that.
Oh,
like, the lyrical wordplay, the metaphor of using the word two, and using it, first of all, everybody knows the word two.
Man,
you got
T-O-T-T-W-O-2,
and you got T-O-O. They're all different, you know, definitions of the word two, and he's using them all intertwined and telling a story. I mean, Jay-Z's that guy, like, when it comes to lyrical wordplay. But I would say that Jay-Z learned how to ride a beat from Biggie, which is something that he used for, you know, that prime decade of his career. From Hard Rock Life up until, I would say, like, American Gangster, right?
Yeah.
He used that ride and that beat wave. You know what I'm saying? Like, with Jay-Z, like, he was bringing the lyrics. He was bringing the dopest features, the dopest producers, you know what I'm saying? The dopest artwork, the dopest tours. Like, when you talk about everything when it comes to rap, all encompassing, I mean, Jay-Z was all of it. And a lot of the stuff that all the rappers are doing now, like from a business sense, from a musical sense, from a production sense, you know what I mean? Jay-Z's kind of, you know, one of the pioneers of that. So that's why he's not number one rapper of all time. Right? And he's got the music to back it up, too. You know, I mean, shit, I even love, you know, older Jay-Z, 444, like, you know, even though he's rapping about a lot of stuff I can't relate to, you know, I never bought a Picasso. You know what I'm saying? Like,
but you know what?
I can't relate to it, but, you know, I like it. It gives you something to aspire to.
Exactly. I mean, the whole, a lot of these rappers, a good rapper won't rap to you expecting you to resonate to it. They're rapping to you to tell you something, to tell you a story, like this is what it's like, whether it's about, you know, like you said, Picasso or whatever, or even like a lot of hood shit, like you won't really resonate with it, but like it's like, wow, it paints a picture, like, wow, this is how people live, this is what they're going through, whatever. But you brought up Jay-Z as your number one, so one of my favorite conversations to have, and we can have it quickly, is Takeover versus Ether.
Oh, I mean, it's Ether all day. And I know Ether, people
really?
People can say Takeover's a better song. I'll give you that. Takeover's a better song. Yo, no, we said, you know, Mustache had a whiskey back of rap compared to Beige and Rap. No, hey, like, come on, like,
when you mentioned Hawaiian shirts and Jazzo earlier, I was like, I was waiting for a moment to kind of sneak in a little Ether lyric for you.
Yeah. Oh, no. Like, I love it. And Jay-Z's my favorite rapper of all time. But, and Takeover is actually a better, structurally, it's a better song than Ether. But Ether has so many jabs, so many, like, dog, no, it's no, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, nah, it's not, it's, to me, it's not even close. And I remember as a little kid, again, I think I wasn't on Napster, but that's, I think I might have been on either LimeWire or Kazaa. By the time I was downloading that. Hey, bro, first of all, anybody who knows me from back in the day, no, I used to hustle the CDs in middle school, burn the CDs, sell them for $5, you know what I'm saying, going, getting a little money in my pocket, going and buying drugs, but that's a whole other podcast for another day, too. I remember downloading it either off of LimeWire or Kazaa. I can't remember which one it was. But when I got that Ether, man, I think I read that thing back 100 times in a row.
Ether is the type of song, you ever sit in a room, I mean, I experienced this, a room with literally, I think there was 14 dudes sitting in an apartment, and somebody had the Nas album, the Ether came on. But let me tell you something, all 14 of us, like in absolute synchrony, we're rapping the song word for word. Ether is that type of song where you kind of just listen to it with your boy and you're both just kind of just rapping along because it's slow paced, it's articulate. I mean, he's shooting straight headshots at Jay-Z with
exactly.
Every
headshot after headshot.
Here's what I'm surprised about. And I guess kind of like me being a pop fan but kind of siding with New York. Is you being a Jay-Z fan signing with Nas to some degree, because the consensus agreement is that Takeover is the better song when you talk to most fans. And I lean both ways. I've started to lean more toward, so at the time I was all about Ether because it was Nas versus Jay-Z. I picked Nas 10 times out of 10. I just did. But Takeover, was more of like we talking about Ether taking headshots and the serious, just angry.
Yeah.
Versus Takeover, which is just kind of like playful. You're so
lame. Exactly. I mean, it's a song. It's a dope song.
And talking about Mobb Deep, I got money stacks bigger than you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like,
yeah. All
about,
of that. Like, we said.
He's talking about
4 hours and 10 years. I could divide. Let's say one is good, one every two. Two of them shits is due.
Two.
Like, yeah.
One was the other was.
Other was
ill value.
That's
a
one hot album every 10-year
average.
Exactly.
So that joint was like, that was a song that you kind of like laughed to and like, oh shit. So
yeah, it's a good song.
They were polar opposites in terms of like the kind of song that it was. And so I think, again, both songs in its own nature was really good. If you wanted to kind of just like, you know, angrily rap and like, you know, talk shit, you know, it's Nas. And if it's you just trying to clown somebody for their height, for being a Carl Kanaan model, you know.
Exactly.
All that stuff,
hey,
like, whoa.
And you know what's crazy? So this leads me, we're going in a completely different direction. I got a couple extra minutes. This is exactly what I wanted. When you came on the podcast to get into a discussion like this. But, you know, my favorite diss song of all time is a combination of both of those. My favorite diss song of all time is Drake's Back to Back because it's a great song, number one. It was a hit song on the radio everywhere. And he got bars. We went at Meek Mill's head on that song. Like, and to me, like, that's like, it's one of the best diss songs of all time.
I agree. Drake, honestly, I don't want to get into a heavy Drake conversation, but Drake is lethal. I mean, he's got bars. He can rap his ass off. And I wish we saw more of the contentious, hard rapper Drake, because I know he can do it. And even if it's a Drake, you know what I mean? Like, we know the whole thing, the whole Canada, Degrassi, you know, the singing and all that. You know what I mean? Damn all that, the ghostwriting. I'm not going to forgive the ghostwriting too much, because it's just sacrilegious to me. But, you know, Drake can rap. And Drake, if he produces some more hard shit, I would listen to it. I would not, you know, try to refuse it, because I like Drake when he has a hard beat on. When he has a hard beat on and he's just, you know, rapping some real, like, you know, like, you know, like hood shit, it's like, all right, that shit is pretty good. But Back to Back was a great track. It's a little bit too soon for me to rank it that high. Like I said, Hit Him Up really kind of, it shakes you to the core. Like, you feel like he's talking to you. Cannabis is diss on LL Cool J.
Mm-hmm.
Second Round Knockout. You remember that?
Yeah, but I remember that. Cannabis, man, come on.
So Cannabis absolutely demolished LL on this. Now, but here's, then you have a whole string of diss songs that G-Unit had on Game and vice versa. Those were fun.
Fifty Cent, Hell Man 2003, 50 Cent ended Ja Rule's career. Like,
yes.
Come on, man.
Yes.
We need a whole podcast just to talk about rap beefs.
Oh,
like,
my God. please, let's do it.
Yeah, hey, that's gonna be on the next one, man. But I think for the people, I gave a disclaimer. That, you know, that you listen to the last 30 minutes of this podcast, you already knew what you were signing up for. For some people, you might have came through, fast forward through the Wizards talk and come straight to this, and I guarantee it was worth your while, man. But you know what I'm doing, man? I greatly appreciate you for coming on, because this is the exact conversation that I wanted to have with you. And now we've actually just opened it up and shared our love of hip-hop with the world. So hopefully people can come through and react and talk to us about it. I want people to have different opinions of the stuff that we said. Man, make sure you talk nice though in the mentions when you come talk to us about this stuff, because we will clap back at you, man. Let them know that.
Sure, man. It was a blast, an absolute blast being on here talking about the Wizards, talking about rappers. What more do you want, man? So I appreciate you having me on, man. We gotta do it way more often, man.
But we're closing out, man. Let the people know where they can find you, and go ahead and plug your work so that the people know that you know you're still out there representing for Hoop District.
For sure, yeah. So Twitter's where I'm at almost every day, upon every hour. If I'm not tweeting, I'm watching you tweet. You can catch me at my handle, ABDU. The number is 11AH. Instagram, heavy on Instagram. So I believe my Instagram link is in my Twitter bio. Please follow me on Instagram. I'll make it worth your while. I got a cute kid, a pretty wife, and so you can see all of it there. And Hoop District DC is the handle for Hoop District. Heavy content coming out. Coming up for training camp. Media Day will be out there. I'll be out there. My man Neil will be out there. I'm sure Troy, you'll be out there with your team.
I'm flying solo right now, but you know, I'll be there though.
Yo, for sure, man. Yeah, so follow me, Hoop District, Abdullah. We'll be here all season, man.
All right, man, that's what's up, man. I appreciate you again for coming on, man. We're gonna have to make you a regular guest on the pod, man, whenever we can pull you away from the family.
For sure, man. Exactly. All right.
Yep.
Good looks.